Rusty Quill presents The Magnus Archives. Episode 9, A Father's Love.
Statement of Julia Montauk regarding the actions and motivations of her father, the serial killer Robert Montauk. Original statement given December 3rd, 2002. Audio recording by Jonathan Sims, head archivist of the Magnus Institute, London. Statement begins. My father was a murderer. There's no way I can reasonably deny it at this point. The evidence provided by the police was overwhelming, and I saw his shed myself. I'm not here to try and clear his name. There wouldn't be much point anyway. As I'm sure you know, he died in prison last year. 7 years isn't much to have served out of a life sentence, but I doubt it was the early parole he'd have hoped for. Sorry, maybe that wasn't in the best taste. Still, his passing is why I feel like I can tell this story. Something I never really felt free to do before now. I always expected him to talk about it during the media frenzy that surrounded his trial. But for whatever reason, he kept quiet. I think I understand a bit more now why he never spoke about it, preferring people draw their own conclusions. But at the time, I couldn't fathom why he just sat there silently, letting others talk for him. I'd like to tell someone now, though. And I've only recently finished my court-appointed counseling sessions, so I'd rather not tell the tabloids and have "My father killed to fuel cult magic," says Daughter of Monster, splashed over page 7 of the weekend edition. So that leaves you guys. Respectable is hardly the word I'd use, but it's better than nothing. So yes, my father killed at least 40 people over the course of the 5 years prior to his arrest in 1995. I won't recount the lurid details. If you're interested, you can look up Robert Montauk in the newspaper archive of any library. There'll be plenty there. The papers clearly didn't care much about the American bombing, because in April of that year they seemed to be talking about nothing but my father. There are also a couple of books on him, none of which I can really recommend, but I guess Ray Cowan's No Bodies in the Shed is the closest to what I'd consider accurate. Although it does imply that I was an accomplice, despite the fact that I was 12 years old at the time. Honestly, I discovered most of the details from the newspapers and the court, just like everyone else. My father spent my formative years killing dozens of people, and I had no idea. But the more I think back over my childhood, the more sure I am that there was something else going on. I don't have any theories as to what any of this means, but I just need to get it down on paper somewhere. And this seems as good a place as any. I've always lived in the same house on York Road in Dartford. Even now, after all that's happened, and all I know about what went on there, I can't bring myself to leave. As far as I know, the shed came with the house. It always sat in the garden, old, wooden, and silent. I don't recall it being used until after the night my mother disappeared. That's when everything started to get strange. My memory of early childhood is patchy, mostly isolated images and impressions, but I remember the night she vanished like it was yesterday. I was 7 years old and had been to the cinema that evening for the first time in my life. We had been to see The Witches at what back then was the ABC down on Shaftesbury Avenue. I had seen films before, of course, on our tiny living room television, but to see a movie on the big screen was awe-inspiring. The film itself was terrifying, though, and even now I'd say it was far scarier than any child's film has a right to be. I remember I spent a lot of it close to tears, but had been so proud of the fact that I hadn't cried at all. When we got home, I lay awake for a long time. That scene where Luke is transformed into a mouse kept playing in my mind, and for some reason it left me too afraid to go to sleep. It was then that I heard a thump from downstairs, like something heavy falling over. I didn't have a clock in my room, so had no idea what the time was, but I recall looking out of the window, and the world was dark and utterly silent. The thump came again, and I decided to go downstairs and see what it was. The landing was almost pitch black, and I tried to be as quiet as possible so nobody would know I was there. The fourth stair down from the top of the staircase always creaked, and still does, in fact. But I don't think I've ever heard it creak louder than it did that night, as I crept down them so slowly. The light downstairs were all turned off, except for the kitchen light, which I could see from the bottom of the stairway. I walked into the kitchen to find it empty. The back door stood open, and a cool breeze blew through it that made me shiver in my pajamas. I saw something shiny laying on the table. Reaching up, I found my mother's pendant. The design had always struck me as beautiful. It was silver, an abstract shape of a hand with a symbol on it that I believe was meant to represent a closed eye. I had never seen her take it off. In my child's mind, I assumed that she had just left it on the table, an accident, and that the open door meant nothing. I went back upstairs, necklace clutched firmly in my hand, to return it to her. She wasn't in bed, of course. The space next to where my father lay, fast asleep, was empty. I gently touched my sleeping father's shoulder, and he awoke slowly. I asked him where Mum was, and he started to say something when he saw the silver chain clutched in my hands. He quickly got out of bed and started to get dressed. As he pulled on a shirt, he asked me where I had found it, and I told him on the kitchen table. Following me downstairs, his gaze was immediately locked on the open door, and he paused. Instead of going outside, he walked over to the kitchen sink and turned on one of the taps. Immediately there began to flow a dark, dirty-looking liquid, and the sick, salty smell of brackish water hit my nose, though at the time I didn't understand that's what it was. The light in the kitchen blew out at that moment, and the room got very dark. My father told me everything was fine, and that I should go back to bed. His hands shook slightly as he took the pendant from me, and I didn't believe him, but I did what I was told anyway. I don't know how long I lay there, waiting for my father to return that night, but I know it was getting light outside when I finally fell asleep. Eventually I woke up. The house was quiet and empty. I had missed the start of school by hours, but that was fine because I didn't want to leave the house. I just sat in the living room, silent and still. It was almost evening again by the time my father actually returned. His face was pale, and he barely looked at me, just walked straight to the cupboard and poured himself a glass of scotch. He sat next to me, drained the glass, and told me that my mother was gone. I didn't understand. Still don't, really. But he said it with such finality that I started to cry, and I didn't stop for a very long time. My father was a policeman, as I'm sure you've read, so as a child I just assumed that the police had looked for my mother and failed to find her. It wasn't until much later that I discovered they'd never even had a missing persons report filed on her. As far as I know, I never had any living grandparents, and apparently no one noticed she was gone, which was strange, as I have vague memories of her having friends over a lot before she vanished. Everyone assumes she was one of my father's first victims, but there was never enough evidence to add it to the official tally. It doesn't really matter. For what it's worth, I don't think he did it. I won't deny it makes sense from the outside, but I remember how devastated he was when she disappeared. He started drinking a lot. I think he did try to look after me as best he could, but most nights he just ended up passed out in his chair. That was also when he started spending a lot of time in the shed. I'd never really paid it much attention before. As far as I was concerned, the sturdy wooden structure was just the home of spiders' nests, and the rusted garden tools my parents would use once a year to attack the overgrown wilderness that was our back garden. But soon after my mother's disappearance, a sturdy new padlock was placed on the door. My father spent a lot of time inside. He told me he was woodworking, and sometimes I'd hear the sound of power tools from inside, and he'd present me with some small wooden token he had made. But mostly there was silence. It should probably have bothered me more than it did, the hours he spent in there, and that odd smell I sometimes noticed, like tinned meat. But I never really paid it much attention, and I had my own grief to deal with. He was gone most nights as well. Often I would wake up from one of my nightmares to find the house silent and empty. I would look for him, and he would be gone. I never despaired at this for some reason, not like I had when my mother vanished. I knew he would return eventually when he was finished with what I had decided must be police business. Sometimes I'd lie awake until he returned. Once, as I lay awake, I heard him come into my room. I pretended to be asleep, I don't know why, but I thought I'd be in trouble if he found out I was awake. He walked over to me, gently stroked my face. His hands smelled strange. Back then I didn't know the scent of blood, and mixed with that faint saline smell of brackish water. He whispered to me then, when he thought I was asleep, promised to protect me, to make sure that it wouldn't get me too. There was a strangled sound to his words, and I think he might have been crying. As he left, I opened my eyes just enough to see him. He stood by the door, his face in his hands, wearing light grey overalls that were stained with a thick, black substance. I often wish I'd asked him about that night. I wonder if he'd known I was awake, if I had asked him in that moment of weakness. Well, it's far too late for that now. Over the next couple of years, I noticed that my father seemed to be injured quite a lot, and there was rarely a time when he didn't have some sort of plaster, bandage, or bruise visible. I'd also occasionally find small blood spots or smears on the floors or tables, especially in the hall. I got very good at cleaning them, but it never occurred to me to pay much attention to where they came from. I just assumed the blood was my father's. He started staying home during the day, and told me he'd been permanently assigned to the night shift. I believed him, of course, and it was only after his arrest that I discovered that had been the